Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, Darren Bresnitz. We are so excited to sit down with Chow Now's CEO and co-founder, Chris Webb. We talk about his lifelong appreciation for food, the start of his company, and where he sees the independent restaurant community heading, and how Chow Now continues to support them. Then we head back to the Brooklyn archives for a classic performance from Loose Buttons, a troupe of native New Yorkers, and they were on there to promote their new single that came out in 2016. One of our favorite performances and something we're super excited to share with you on this Sunday or whenever you're listening. So please sit back, relax, and enjoy Snacky Tunes here on Heritage Radio Network. Chris, thank you so much for taking the time out of your schedule. Sit down, chat with the Snacky Tunes. Welcome to the show.
Cool. Thanks for having me on.
Of course. You know, I was reading about your upbringing in the Toothache magazine, the latest issue, issue 10. And you had mentioned that your mom's side of the family is European. And I have a similar background where my family comes from Europe. And I think I took it for granted growing up about the appreciation of art and culture and food, of not being, not to disparage American upbringing, but when I finally got to Europe in like my 20s, I was like, oh, this tracks so much about what I appreciate in life, especially when it comes to food. How much did that shape you, that European approach to understanding gastronomy? And how different was it from maybe some of like the American kids you grew up with?
Yeah, I think I was very lucky, and it really was a luxury. I grew up in a middle class family here in LA. As you said, my mom is European. She's from London, British. Her parents were from Germany. They left Germany to escape the Nazis and ended up in London. And so half my family is in and around London, and then my dad was from Texas, and his family at the time was all from kind of around Dallas. But to your question, I mean, I remember being on a train in Switzerland with my parents when I was probably, or at least my mom and my sister when I was probably six, and having like going into the food cart and having these like most amazing mushrooms. And I still remember it all, you know, many years. I'm 41 now, so that was, you know, call it 35 years later.
Sure.
And it was the first time I actually enjoyed having a mushroom. And you know, that type of kind of, the fact that I remember it 35 or 36 years later clearly had an influence on my life. And I hated mushrooms up to that. I think most kids probably dislike mushrooms. I know a lot of adults that dislike mushrooms.
I mean, it's the white button mushroom. If I remember from my youth, it's like those rubbery raw ones that sat on top of a salad.
Totally. And so this is on a train. It's not even like a fine dining restaurant. This is on a train in Europe. And it just talks about like how how much different it is. And again, middle-class family. It wasn't like we're traveling like class through like some, you know, amazing kind of private type coach type thing. And this is kind of everyday eating on a train in Europe. And I just remember the mushrooms being so fantastic as a kid, and being so different than anything I had here in LA growing up. So clearly it had some influence on me, and I think quite a bit. And then another influence, I think I talk about it in that Toothache article that you're referencing. Mm-hmm. I was very lucky that a very good friend of mine in elementary school, his dad was a very well-known famous chef, James Beard chef. Mm-hmm. And they lived two blocks from my house. And I'd just go over there and kind of hang out as kids do.
Yeah.
Dad would be in the kitchen cooking everyone food. And again, it was like very elevated. It wasn't your average kind of going down the block to your friend's house.
No.
It was that kind of exposure. And I think a lot about that. I've fell out of touch with my friend, and I'm back in touch with him. We were actually texting yesterday, and it's kind of
nice.
Amazing. Yeah, it's amazing how much kind of your childhood influences the rest of your life.
I mean, I had a friend who I grew up with, wound up becoming a professional chef in Chicago, now in San Francisco. And I even remember in middle school, we'd be baking at one of our houses, and he'd be like, oh, scraping a vanilla bean pod. And I was like, okay. I was like, I'd never seen that before. And then you see them go into food or still be related to food years later. And I think it's probably more common now, but since you and I are the same age, this idea of food being any sort of through line or narrative, especially coming from that sort of background, wasn't the norm. How much did you keep coming back to food? Because I know you went to Wall Street. I know you did like the business sort of finance track. Was food always in your mind? Was it always playing in the back? Were you the guy who was like, all right, we're Wall Street's closed, we're punching out. Chris, where are we eating?
Yeah, it fell off. I think a lot of my interests fell off in high school and changed in high school, and then I kind of came back to it. That includes like sports growing up as a kid. Like I love basketball, played a fair amount of it, went to high school, and like in high school you just start to kind of gravitate to other things, and I did. And then kind of in my 20s I came back to a number of things, including watching basketball again and starting to play again, but also food. The other influence was living in New York. So I've kind of lived in two cities of my life, LA, which is the vast majority of it, and then New York for about 6 years. and living in New York, I think you have to love food and restaurants and kind of the restaurant scene because you know, you got to get out of your shoebox apartment and there's only so many places to go and you can only spend so much time at Central Park. So you end up spending a lot of time in restaurants and spending a fair amount of money in restaurants. And if you don't like them, you're not going to like living in New York very much. And so that took this kind of love of restaurants as a kid, or love of food at least, and kind of brought it back into my life and then kind of grew from there, from call it my early 20s through my late 20s.
I mean, we were both in New York in our 20s during that time. And that was a very special time in the food scene in New York. Now, I was a PA and bartending on the weekends. I was not working in Wall Street. So you probably had a little bit more liquidity to go out to eat. Where were you dining at that time? What was speaking to you? What do you remember from that scene?
Yeah. So yes. However, you probably had more hookups and connections than I did in the restaurant, you know, in the world there in New York. So, you know, I'm sure you lived large and enjoyed some really great things.
A lot of dumplings, like five dumplings for a dollar. I'll tell you that much during that time.
I mean, that is a great thing about New York is that you know, you can go and spend just a boatload of money, but you can eat some amazing kind of street food and things for under 10 or 15 bucks as well. So, you know, the place that I loved, and I just kind of, I forgot why I went there in the first place. Someone had told me about it, but Blue Ribbon Brasserie, kind of the original Blue Ribbon on Sullivan in Soho, not the sushi joint, but the real kind of original brasserie, which is still there. And it was open, still is probably open till 4 a.m. and you can go. And so when you're in 20s, you stay out pretty late. You kind of bounce around and probably drink a little too much and indulge. And for years, I would end up at Blue Ribbon. It was kind of my go-to. And it's like, I was probably 26 or 27 at the time. It felt so large, just eating like steak tartare and oysters and paella and all this stuff at 3 a.m. after being
so
at the bar.
Good.
It was amazing. And so I remember eating, like, the paella was fantastic. You'd order way too much. I was probably consuming like 3,000 calories at that dinner. It's just not healthy at all, but it's things you
Yeah, but when you're 26, it's fine. It's fine. It's a little different now when we're dads over 40. Yeah,
totally. And then I'd box up the paella, bring it home, pass out, and then wake up, you know, late morning and finish it off as like a kind of a brunch at my house, in my living room or on the couch. But Blue Ribbon was a place that, like, over time I probably spent more money at and more time at. And again, usually it was at like from 2 a.m. to 3:30 a.m. It was kind of my go-to there. But it was such a fun scene and crowd, and the food was so awesome.
A lot of chefs there too. I mean, that was, and I don't know if it still is, but like that place was the haunt for a lot of chefs who got off their own shifts and wanted a great place to eat late at night.
Yeah, it was a great collection of a whole bunch of different kind of scenes coming together at the, you know, again at 2 or 3 a.m. And yeah, definitely kind of chef and restaurant folks were there. And then you'd get, you know, people like me coming off from bars down the block that were hungry again. And, you know, we had dinner at probably 9 p.m. and then 6 hours later, we're back eating again. There, and I live kind of nearby in West Village area. I lived a block away from Joe's Pizza, so consumed a lot of Joe's Pizza as
Shout
well.
Shout out. You and me both.
Yeah. So that was great. Still is. Blue Ribbon, unfortunately, the last time I went there, it wasn't the same. And maybe there's a little bit of nostalgia in my mind that kind of had fallen off. But, you know, it's been a while. For me, it's been 15 years from kind of the time I was just describing. And things change. Blue Ribbon kind of owned this like little block within the West Village. They had the bakery, which was awesome, which is no longer there. They had a wine bar, which I think is there. And then they had this tiny little market that was probably about 250 square feet. My friend Sasha worked there. I met him because he was the GM of it, ran it. And he was definitely into food, and he educated me on a lot of stuff. And I'd go and have all these amazing kind of open-faced toasts that he'd prepare in this tiny little market and sit around. And felt like I was probably like a 85-year-old Italian man, you know, just hanging out, loitering in this place. And, you know, I was in my 20s. And you just sit there, drink a cup of coffee, kind of shoot the shit for a while and eat some good food. And Sasha's, you know, he's actually part of the team here at Chinatown these days, which is kind of cool how things come full circle.
I mean, but, those connections with food. I mean, when did you start? Was that your introduction into developing relationships and restaurants and chefs, or understanding how the restaurant world works? Or was there another time in your life when you started thinking about getting involved deeper in the culinary scene other than just a guest?
Yeah. So kind of two things happened roughly within the same year while I was living in New York. One, on a random whim, my mom invested in Tender Greens when they had one location that was open for a week in Culver City. And again, not something that we have ever done before. It was just kind of a spur of the moment. She liked the three founders, got to know them just as a customer of the restaurant and started chatting. She's very extroverted and chats with anyone that will chat with her, and chatted with them and eventually called me up and said that she wanted to invest. And I said it was a bad idea, but she did it anyway. And it paid off. It was a good call. So I'm glad she followed through and ignored my advice back then. So that got me paying a little bit more attention to the restaurant scene or business side of the restaurants. I also had become friends with the woman that runs an amazing group of restaurants in New York called Caracas.
They rape a place.
Yeah, and I think it's so amazing. And at the time, they had the East Village location, which is the original, which is unfortunately no longer there. I don't think it made it through the pandemic. But she had opened the location in Williamsburg, and then went out in
Rockaway.
Yeah, Rockaway is what I was trying to think of. Yeah, and her and I had become friends, and I said, like, this will kill it in LA. Like this concept, what you do, the price point, the flavors, like. And there's not a whole lot like it in LA. There's very little like it. There's obviously a lot of Mexican food and kind of other food. But I think anyone that probably likes Mexican food would love an arepas and speak to a bunch of other people. So I think there's a huge audience for it here in LA. And so I was working with her and her husband at the time about trying to get them out to LA and open locations. And we were even made trips out to LA. And I, at that point, was kind of moving back to LA. We looked at locations. We looked at locations on Rose Ave. Again, this is probably like 2008, 2009. It didn't come to be. Her and her husband at the time separated. They're still business partners, but they said, well, this is probably not a great idea to open new locations 3,000 miles away while we're going through this. And so that never came to be, but I spent some time with them. We're still friends, but spent time with them.
And then is this also when you started to understand the difference between, I guess I'll call it corporate, like larger restaurants and independent restaurants, and what comes with being an independent restaurant, especially in this modern economy?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's also what I prefer to eat. If you look at my credit card statement, you'll see where I spend money. It rarely is as a chain, an occasional In-N-Out burger or something like that. But for the most part, I've always loved independent restaurants. And I think that was kind of the influence of my parents, who kind of avoided fast food and chains like that. You know, we got a Happy Meal on our birthday, and that was the only thing we had in our life as a kid. And also back to the European influence, I think a little bit. Something like 60 or 70% of restaurants in the U.S. are independently owned and kind of mom and pop independents, and the rest are larger groups, the McDonald's, Starbucks type. In Europe, it's even more skewed. It's 80% of restaurants are independent. So just spending more time there as a kid during kind of summers and getting exposed to that. So, I mean, it's been deep in kind of my DNA, I think. And so... You know, I like so many other people, and probably so many people that you know and, you know, potentially listen to this, love independence restaurants and just the creativity that comes from it, I think. For the argument that franchisees are local business owners as well, and while technically they may be true, I think what gets lacked is the creativity of starting your own restaurant and, not be given the ingredients and the menu and everything else, but it is creating the everything from the ambiance to the menu to everything else that goes into the experience of an independent restaurant that makes it so great. So I've gravitated to referring them as independent restaurants or local restaurants these days, just because I think it's the independence that I'm attracted to and really love.
Amazing. Well, listen, let's take a quick musical break, and we come back. I wanted to talk about the turn and the start of Chow Now, and about what you are doing to work with independent restaurants. We have a song from the archives here on Snacky Tunes on Heritage Radio Network.
Oh.
Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We're here with Chris Webb. And right before the break, you were talking about your love for independent restaurants. And it's one thing to love and want to invest in a restaurant. It's quite another thing to build a business around them that supports them. When did you start thinking about the initial idea of how you would work or what you could bring to working with independent restaurants, given your background and experience?
Yeah, I had always wanted to start my own business at some point. So I was always kind of toying with ideas. What could I do? This goes back to kind of like high school days of just kicking around ideas and never really getting anything off the ground, but always wanting to really do something of my own. And I didn't go that path in my early 20s. I ended up going and working at investment banks, trading stocks, and kind of fell into it. I didn't go to college. One of these things where like the internship turns into a full-time job and all of a sudden I'm living in New York and it was great. I love it. I'm very, very happy. I got lucky that way. But I had always thought, okay, at some point I'm gonna start my own business. So I was always looking at ideas and toying with ideas. I love tech. Again, that was partly kind of growing up in the 90s, the age of AOL and the internet coming to be and being around that. And so getting that in my, you know, I think I was in middle school when that stuff started to kind of come to be in life. And so got that. When I started to talk to restaurant owners like Maribel, like the team at Tender Greens, one of the founders, his name is David. I spent time talking to him on the subject. It was clear that independent restaurants didn't have an option to take their business online in an effective way. And we're talking about time frame to give you some references, like 2010 going into 2011, right? And so at that point, if you go back, the iPhone came out in 2008. The App Store wasn't originally open. It was only Apple apps for a little bit. About a year and a half later, Apple opened up the App Store to outside developers. And so some of the first apps to go in there were from the big chain. So Domino's was very quick to build an app that allowed you to order food. Starbucks was kind of shortly after them. And you had all these big chains kind of rushing into building their own apps, submitting it. And they saw a ton of success. And Domino's was very vocal on their, you know, publicly traded company. So they have to kind of report things back to their shareholders publicly. And they said, you know, this thing is dominating. We're doing so well. No one wants to call up a pizzeria on a Friday night and put on hold for 5 minutes and place the order and ring the credit card on the phone. And, you know, I think people forget how painful it is ordering over the phone, but it was a pain. There's a ton of friction in it. And so Domino's came out with the app, said it's really easy. You can track your order. You don't have to talk to anybody. And it was a huge success overnight. But they also said, we think we're going to put independent pizzerias out of business because this, like, they didn't go as far as saying their pizza may be better than ours, but they kind of implied it. They basically said the pizza doesn't matter anymore. It's all about the convenience wins. And they're very much right on that standpoint.
Sure.
And so it's somebody that fears a world that is just Taco Bell and Domino's and nothing else. The idea came, well, how do we build a platform that allows any independent restaurant, regardless of their budget, their know-how, how technical they are, to bring their brand online and maintain that direct connection that they have with their diner base, of which many have grown over, you know, years and years and years. And they have people that want to order takeout from them and who do order takeout from them. But it was so inconvenient placing that order over the phone. So the only option when you go back about a decade for independent restaurants was to join something like a Grubhub, or back then it was E24. In New York, it was Seamless. They're all now owned by Grubhub these days. And if you talk to independent restaurant owners, they said, like, they're taking our customers. They don't share any of the information with us. So we're losing that direct connection with our own diners. But not only that, they're charging 20 to 30% commissions on every single order. And if you know kind of the margins within the restaurant industry, they're taking all the profits and leaving us with nothing else.
It's so wild.
And we were hearing this a decade ago. It's only got worse since then. And in New York, you know, New Yorkers are very outspoken most of the time. And so I would talk to some of the restaurant owners who are like, yeah, it's like the new mafia. They'd come in. They're like, okay, now we're going to charge you 15% of that order.
Yeah,
and
then
a year later, when they have like a few more customers using, they're like, you know, now it's 17%. And year after year after year, that commission just kept going up and up and up. And so it wasn't a good option. And so the original idea for Chanel, which is still the core of what we do a decade later, is to allow any independent restaurant to get online, have their own ordering system, whether it's order on their website, for the right restaurants building their own branded apps, if they need their own branded apps, giving them a customer database, helping them with automated marketing, basically everything that Starbucks, Domino's, and others have built, put it in a box and offer it for $100 or a couple $100 a month to independent restaurants. And we now have about 22,000 restaurants on our platform that use our system. And we've launched different product lines and a whole bunch of different features and restaurants. Now it's kind of, we offer it a la carte. So restaurants can pick and choose of which, you know, what they need of what we offer. But it's we've been very lucky. We've grown nicely. And I think we tapped into something that was needed and continues to be needed.
Going back to those early days, how did you convince those original customers or partners, if you will, of independent restaurants to work with you, given that the only thing in the marketplace was these very predatory types of businesses?
Yeah. So even back then, and it's hard to imagine, one, when we launched, fax machines were still actively being used at restaurants, which is kind of crazy to think. You know, restaurants historically as an industry are usually kind of late adopters to a lot of things. And stick, you know, once they have something that kind of works somewhat well, they stick with it. And fax machines were a thing. We still today have restaurants that receive their order via fax, which is crazy that like, we like at some point we're just like, we got to kill this thing off. But we have a few, I think it's a couple hundred restaurants on our system that are like, yeah, can you fax the order into us? Which is just shocking in this day and age.
Wait a second. But who are the other people on the other side doing the faxing?
So our system automates it. So you order online.
Okay.
You order online. You pay online. Like from the diner side of it, it's just as convenient. You order on the website or anything else. And then we take that, we process it, and then to actually get that order to the restaurant, most of the times, these days, there's multiple options for restaurants. We can integrate into the point of sale system, depending on the point of sale system they use. We provide tablets if they want a tablet. We can email them the order, or we can fax them. And the fact that we still have fax as an option just shocks me. But anyway, back to your question about the conversations in the early days. A lot of it back then was convincing them that they needed online ordering and this was a thing and this was going to grow. And the big chains latched onto it and they adopted it very quickly and they saw a lot of success from it. The independents back then, some of them got it, right? Like a lot of different opinions in the industry. Some people were very quick to adopt it, said, absolutely, yeah, we need this and signed up and started reaching out to us to sign up. It wasn't even us convincing them. It was them convincing themselves and they're reaching out to us, which was always, you know, makes the sales cycle easier for our sales team. Fast forward kind of 5 or 6 years, at that point, the industry had been changed quite a bit and online ordering is clearly a much bigger thing and this kind of known entity. And so then the conversation with restaurant owners had shifted a little bit to not, do you need online ordering? They were convinced they needed online ordering, but you need to own your own system. You need to own your customer base and you need to own 100% of your revenue. So stop using Grubhub or somebody else, or at least don't stop using it, but at least layer your own system in.
Yeah.
And try as best you can, and here's some kind of tools and options and a playbook to move as many of your diners to order directly from you as possible. And a lot of restaurants have followed through with that. And you know, we've played a part in that. Part of it is restaurants offering much better menu prices. Basically, they're real menu prices when you order direct from them. Yeah. So our menu prices tend to be what you would get in store. You often go on, you know, DoorDash, Uber, Grubhub, any of them. And, you know, I hear this all the time. It's like, how is that sandwich that's normally like $12, $22
on
streets?
Mediocre $25 salad.
Yeah, exactly. And so there's a few factors there, but that's restaurants having to recoup those crazy commissions that they have to pay. And so they have to inflate their menu prices to just offset that 30% commission that they're paying out to Grubhub or any of the other delivery apps out there.
You know, the pandemic really upended the world for independent restaurants, because while some of the restaurants you're talking about offer takeout, that's part of their business, some of the most well-known independent restaurants never did takeout before. It was, if you wanted to experience them, you had to come in and eat, but many of them had to pivot during this time. How did you play a role in supporting those restaurants in the pandemic, especially ones who had never really done takeout before? And then what have you seen stick now that we've come out of it and people have returned to dining into these types of places?
Yeah. So when the pandemic, when COVID hit in kind of spring of 2020, so March of 2020, at that point, we were kind of onboarding hundreds of restaurants a month, and it went immediately to thousands of restaurants a month. And so we hired a lot of people that were laid off from the industry, right? The industry, there was a massive amount of layoffs in a very short period of time because restaurants were kind of shutting down, shutting their dining rooms if they had to. And so a lot of these restaurant, employees, they knew us, they knew our system, they knew how it worked, and they needed a job quickly. And so we hired, like 150 people that had been laid off from the industry, maybe up to close to 200 in spring of 2020. And we trained them very quickly to help onboard other restaurants so that they could take orders online, because every restaurant had to now all of a sudden take orders online, and their entire business was taken out for a period. And so there were people on our team that were onboarding restaurants at 3 a.m. Like it was around the clock work for about 2 to 3 months there. And to your point, we brought on restaurants that had never done takeout, that were kind of more fine dining. One that I ended up ordering a lot at was at the time I lived in Venice. And so Felix in Venice was, anyone that knows Felix was, it's still an awesome restaurant.
You should be so lucky to get that type of food at home. You should be so lucky.
I know they didn't want, they never wanted to do it. It's not how they want their food to be consumed, but it traveled so well. We would order, I ate Felix on my couch probably 3 times a week.
But to that focaccia was still warm.
It was so good. The pizza, they did batch cocktails, they did batch Negronis. You'd get kind of like these, I think it was like $30 for kind of 3 Negronis in a kind of a big flask, I think.
The batch cocktails from everyone, like getting a perfectly made martini from a place like Friedman's or something like that. I was like, I know people are struggling right now, but I'm going to take a little bit of joy in this perfect drink that I don't want to make for my home bar.
Yeah. I mean, I remember the orders that we got from Felix, the meatballs, you get like one other pizza as a meatball, maybe a pasta. Actually, the pasta, I think they were doing pasta kits, and we did that a couple of times as well. But anyway, put on plenty of weight in a short period of time because of Felix. and I thought the food traveled so well, as did many other people, because they did a decent amount of a lot of orders. I think people were very happy that they could eat Felix at their house over that time period. But Felix no longer offers takeout, which I was kind of disappointed in, and not for business reasons and Chan Hao reasons, for customer
personal reasons.
Yeah, and I think a lot of other people feel that way. I was hoping that they'd take over the restaurant next door and just run it as kind of like a takeaway, kind of like Jelena does their takeaway out of the space next door. But what we have seen is some of those kind of Felix stories that like they had to bring in the revenue to just stay alive. And then when the dining room reopens, they turn it off. That's a little bit more rare. What we have seen is restaurants really see the revenue that comes from it and create a very specific limited menu just for takeout that works well, that travels well, that they can kind of do where it doesn't screw up there at the kitchen for the dining room. And we see a fair amount of that as well. And I think that's kind of going to be settled into the new normal.
Yeah, I mean, I think this hybrid model has definitely worked, and I've seen some restaurants who have completely moved away from relying on Grubhub or DoorDash or any of these ones and have their own Chow Now platforms. I think of Homestate, I think of Ronin. But obviously, as that deflated a little bit of people who just saying we're going back to this type of in dining only, and we're not going to need the Chow Now services. How have you had to pivot as a business? How, was there any tough pills you had to swallow, especially as, it's not your fault. It's just things inflated and then deflated.
Yep. Yeah. So, as I kind of view the world and we're now entering the second decade of our life at Chow Now, and I think about kind of what does that have and kind of think about it as like Chow Now 2.0 in a sense. Our core product, the one that we originally launched with, that we've been building out and adding features and making better and better over time, it is still awesome and still used by many, many thousands of restaurants. And every single day we have more thousands of, not thousands, but we have restaurants signing up every single day to use that product and that suite of software that we provide them. And they can pick and choose how they want to use it and brand it for themselves and use all the customer data that comes off of it, however they choose. As I look into the industry though, since we launched, there have basically been two different ways of doing online ordering in the restaurant industry. There is direct ordering, which is what I wouldn't go as far as saying we pioneered it, but I think we were among the pioneers that were working on direct ordering. We were very early on that, and we're very, very much convinced that was best for restaurants, and still believe it's the best option for restaurants because they own the customer, they maintain the relationship with the diner, the data, and then also they don't pay any commission, so they keep 100% of the revenue, you know, subtracting for credit card fees that you can't avoid. And so it is a much better option for restaurants, which is why you see someone like Ronin and so many other restaurants say order direct from us. It's way better for us and it's better for you. But if you look at from the consumer side, I said there's two options. Ordering direct is that one option. The other option and business model is the DoorDash, Uber Eats, Grubhub business model, which is kind of one app. It's a marketplace. And on the consumer side, it's very convenient. It's convenient having one app with a lot of restaurants in it. It's convenient having one account that works across all these restaurants, one credit card, et cetera. So there's a lot of convenience for it. When you order direct at a restaurant, you have to dig around for their website. You have to kind of navigate to it. It's a few clicks away. If you want to have mobile apps on your phone, you have to have a few. It's probably fine having one or two mobile apps on your phone for restaurants. You probably don't want 10 of them on your phone. Right. And so
I just have Home State. It's my number one. It's my number one. I go to it every week. But yes, I can understand not wanting to have 15 different restaurant apps.
Totally. And someone like Home State or like Sugarfish is another client of ours. When you have a brand like that in multiple locations, it makes sense.
Sure.
But from a consumer standpoint, again, you have one on your phone. What we see on average is customers having maybe two or three restaurant apps. You don't tend to have a massive portfolio of restaurant apps on your phone.
And also, I don't want to have to guess as a consumer, like, are they on Chow Now? Do they have their own app? Can someone just aggregate it for me? Going back to what you said about
where's the convenience, website?
The less friction part of it is just like, let me pull up this one catch-all.
Totally, totally. And so what we are now working on is cherry-picking what we think are the best of those two concepts and bring it to one app, which is the Chano app. So all the benefits of direct ordering, again, no commissions, the restaurant keeps 100% of the revenue, they keep the customer info, the relationship, the data, but the convenience of one app, one place to go, one customer account. And so we think that's the best of both worlds there. And that's what we're working on right now actively. So the Chano app is something that over this year, we invested quite a bit into. I think personally, the app's got quite good. We've made reordering super simple, so you can find your favorite restaurants, reorder the same dish, the same orders from the same restaurants. You can discover other restaurants on our platform. You know that the restaurant, when you order on Chano, 100% of the revenue is going, so you don't have to dig around from different websites, different apps. And so we believe this is kind of the future of what the industry needs. And so we now are allowing any independent restaurant to join our marketplace. You don't have to use a full suite of software. We think the industry needs an alternative. We don't think the current path of delivery apps is sustainable. If you talk to restaurant owners, many of them are very vocal. Caitlin and obviously over at Ronin is very vocal, but she's one of many that are very vocal. And so we want to build a competitor out there. I think Resy has done a very good job changing the industry. When they launched, OpenTable was a monopoly. There was no one that was close to OpenTable, and restaurants hated the fact that they gave up money on every single cover to OpenTable. Resy launched and said, screw it. Like, we're not going to charge you per cover. You just like use the platform. And, if you get, 1,000 bookings from us per month, like, awesome. You don't have to pay us thousands of dollars just for that. And now if you look, OpenTable has changed their business model. They don't charge like they used to. And I think Resy should get a lot of credit and probably deserves more credit than they even get for changing the reservation game and the way that restaurants pay and how much the industry is now saving. The one that suffered was OpenTable. They make less revenue than they did 8 years ago. We want to do the same thing on the online ordering space and really shake things up where, hopefully restaurants don't have to pay these crazy commissions and they get all the data and everything else. And from a selfish Chanel standpoint, it'd be better if no one copied us and we were unique in this model. But I also don't think that Uber and others can change their business model at this point. I think they're kind of stuck given how much money they make on every single order. They'd really put themselves in tough binds. And so anyway, we are actively working on the Chano app. We think it should be an alternative to Grubhub, Uber Eats, and others out there, and something that restaurants really want to be a part of and don't feel like they need to be a part of. I think, unfortunately, they feel like they need the list on Uber Eats. We hate that. We want them to be a part of it, not feel like they need to be a part of it.
No, I know. And that, I think it just comes with time and building community, which I think you guys are doing a really good job of. And I'm excited to see where the app goes. I will definitely be continuing to use it and things like that. I want to ask one more question before I let you go, because now that you're a dad, now that you're traveling, now that the world is reopening, you know, you had your own mushroom moment as a child. What food moment are you hoping to share with your family that obviously they don't need to follow in the same footsteps, but maybe puts them on their same culinary journey that you started when you were a kid?
Yeah, I think it's just exposure to different types of food. Our son is three. We take him out with us almost wherever we eat these days. Some exceptions. There's a couple of date nights here and there, but
of course
he eats a lot with us. Yeah. And we tried to offer him everything that we're eating. Mm. I've now been to Crudo y Nudo on Main Street a couple times, and he's been with us every single time. The first time we went, we had ordered two of their uni taco little dishes, which are delicious. One for me and one for my girlfriends. He ended up eating my entire thing. I barely got a bite of it. And so a three-year-old eating uni, I didn't think he was going to, I just offered him a bite. I thought it was going to be disgusting and he wanted to finish it. That said, we just went this past weekend, intentionally ordered three, one for him, given kind of what happened last time where I didn't get one and he didn't want to touch it. He was just like, not in the mood for it. So, you know, this, you know, kids, toddlers are fickle and you don't really know what you're going to get any day of the week. So, but you know, we offer him everything we can anytime we try something.
Awesome. I love it. Well, Chris, thank you so much for taking the time with us. If people want to follow along with the developments of the company or just put the app on their phone, where can they go for the company? And then where can they go to follow you for your own adventures?
Yeah. So, you know, a plug for the Chano app. We think it's getting very good. We've been investing in it. We have a bunch of new features rolling out into the Chano app. So you can get it in the App Store, or if you have an Android in the Play Store. That's number one thing. My handle on Instagram, which I'm starting to post just a tad bit more after taking a couple of years off, and which is why I have to actually look up my handle to verify it, because I just haven't talked about it for a while.
It's well, good. One, the channel. I follow. Okay. I enjoy your trips.
I had two personal goals this year that I set for myself. One was posting more of just food and restaurants and channel on Instagram. So I'm working on that. So not the easiest handle, but CW3BB. So CW3BB. And then the channel account is much better than mine and much more active. And we have some really good people working on that. And that's just at channel.
Yeah. You're at the luxury of hiring someone who's saying
who knows what the hell they're doing. Yeah,
who knows what the hell they're doing. Yeah. Yes. Not to take a wild swing, but probably younger than the two of us, I would say as well.
I would bet that this is the case. I don't know her age, but I would put money on it. She's younger than me. So.
Yeah. At all the companies I've worked at, whenever I've hung out with the social media manager, I'm like, I hope you don't think I'm too old and that I'm still cool. Well, Chris, thank you so much. Appreciate it. And thank you to your team for helping set this up. We have a song from the archives and then a live performance here on Snacky Tunes on Heritage Radio Network. Thank you.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to a brand new series on Heritage Radio Network called The Culinary Call Sheet, where we give a peek into the back kitchen of culinary media. I'm your host, April Jones.
And I'm your co-host, Darren Bresnitz. Part of why we started this show was to offer an unofficial mentorship for anyone who is interested in learning about all aspects of food and video, whether that's TV, social media, online, or just something you want to do for fun.
Absolutely. What was once niche or a little silly, as I'm sure you remember, Darren, when we started out.
Yes, ma'am.
Has now become such a massive playing field for so many creatives using food as the medium.
It's something that has driven us professionally and personally for so many years. What excites me the most about this show is that we're going to sit down with some of the industry leaders to hear how they made it and what drew them into this industry.
With 20 years in the culinary production game ourselves, we're hoping we can give, through these conversations, an insider's view into personal stories from the field, as well as an in-depth behind-the-scenes look into some of the most popular food programming in today's evolving culinary media landscape.
We'll be covering everything from how to style your food, to how to license IP, to developing your own ideas, and some tips from the masters of how to host your own show.
Yeah, it's a little bit of conversation, how to, and how do you do the things that you do in culinary media, which I'm so excited about. I love so many of the guests that are coming on this season. We have talent from Food Network, from Vice Media, Eater, Refinery 29.
We've met some of the best people in the world, both in front of and behind the camera. And we're bringing them all together to share their stories, their delicious adventure, and their unique journey into this crazy world.
So to be the first to hear our episodes when they launch this fall, go to wherever podcasts are streaming and hit subscribe. And make sure to give us a follow at The Culinary Call Sheet on Instagram.
Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We're here with Loose Buttons live in studio. Hello, boys.
How's it going?
What's going on?
You want to go around the room and introduce yourselves?
Yes. I'm Eric. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
I am Emmanuel Silverstein.
I'm Zach.
And I'm Adam.
Yeah, we can hear you
distance.
From back. Yeah, in the back. I always feel like the drummers get like the short end of the stick. They're just like, yeah, just shove them in the back corner. Don't say anything. Well, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
On our first show back in 2016 on this like oddly rainy, but unseasonably warm day. You guys had just played Knitting Factory this week, right?
Yeah, we played it yesterday.
How was the show?
It was amazing.
Amazing.
The fans were out of control. It was a beautifully packed room. For us, you know, we really feed off the crowd's energy.
Yeah.
Fans were great.
Well, how far into the show did you guys like pick up on the energy? Like, okay, this is like not your average show.
What song do you think?
I would say before the show.
Yeah, maybe.
Like, we could tell there was a couple other bands playing with us, and like everyone was there was a little baby who was just kind of like on someone's shoulders, like jumping up in the crowd. And from then on, we just knew it was
adorable, by the way.
Yeah.
She was 4 years old and like...
Were they responsible parents and like had the oversized...
No, that's the crazy thing. She was 4 years old, not even earplugs.
I can't. I like can't abide by it. Like, yeah. You know, like that to me just seems like, you know, like bring your kid out, but...
I think it's adorable when a baby also wears the headphones, too.
I think it's like a strong look. Like, yeah. I think like as adults would not be able to pull it off. Like, you could not go in there like, hey, how's it going? Like, take off your headphones, please.
Exactly.
See, but kid up to a certain age, I have seen fathers who are still in bands, Les Evifav, like strap their kids to their chest when they were babies and like they had the headphones on.
I mean... I wish her parents put those headphones on.
Yeah, or maybe they forgot them, or I don't know. I mean, the hearing's going to go one way or the other. Exactly. You just want to, like, hold it off as long as possible.
Exactly.
So how did you guys all meet? And you grew up together, right?
Yeah, so I have known Zach now for, like, 11 years, 12 years. We've been playing music for pretty much that long.
Yeah, these guys are 50 for people who...
yeah, so we met in sixth grade, and, like, literally, like, I think the second day of school... Zach and I just started playing music together, and we've been doing it ever since. And then, you know, we played music in high school, and then when we went off to separate colleges, we still wanted to keep it going.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to the University of Miami, and my freshman year roommate is this guy right here, Manny. And we brought him on board, and then we stole the best drummer on campus to round us out, and now we've got Swagman Jones, aka Adam,
sitting in the back corner. How has it's interesting. It's like, you know, it's like young love in a sense. Like you know, you grow together. So did you guys push each other like to develop differently, or how did you guys develop your writing talent, like your skills? Like, were you like, hey man, you got to practice a little bit more. Like, I'm getting a little bit better than you. Like, how did that kind of evolve over the years?
Definitely. I mean, Zach is probably pushes me subtly and subconsciously probably the most of any member in this band. And definitely, like, it's this kind of this back and forth where we kind of I watch him grow, because, you know, he went to a different college as me. So whenever we'd meet back, you know, during our breaks, I'd see how much he's grown as a musician. And that's my motivation to then catch up to him. And I can't speak for him, but that's kind of my motivation there a little bit.
Well, yeah, I mean, I went to a very different school. I went to Wesleyan. I don't know if anyone,
yeah,
you know Wesleyan.
I've been there.
Yeah, yeah. It's a kind of a crazy place. So huge music scene, mm-hmm. a lot of weird music. So, yeah. So, but we kind of took that, you know, as an advantage, I'd say, and like
exactly.
kind of expanded our horizons in while we were at school. So
exactly.
Cool. Let's hear a song. Perfect. Why don't you play us a tune?
We love tunes.
Okay, great. What are you going to play first?
What about Thrill?
Let's do it.
Okay, cool.
Thank you. I came up with that one.
Loose Buttons, live on Snacky Tunes.
Just fun. I get lost in the thrill sometimes. Oh, I get lost in the thrill sometimes. No, I won't stop letting you go. stop letting her go. No, I won't stop letting her go. I won't stop.
Since you guys have been playing together since sixth grade, are there any songs that have stayed? Or like, what's the oldest song you guys play? Or if you had to retire some of the older tunes or all of them?
We retire a lot of songs, much to the chagrin of a lot of our older fans.
A lot of them are gone.
Yeah. Thankfully, we're in a prolific writing period now.
So, yes. Yeah.
So our newer shows, we're playing more of our new songs.
Oh, okay. Yeah. The music.
The oldies.
Is there, like, anyone in particular that's still, like, a point of, like, please, like, I want to keep playing it, but everyone else is kind of like, past its prime?
Well, we have, like, the opposite scenario. We have a song that the people want us to play a lot that we don't really want to play a lot as much.
No, we have another one, though, that I want to play.
Retrobox.
We have a
Zach versus the rest of us, one of those.
You guys
as well.
Can check out Retrobox. It's on YouTube.
It's really good.
Might not be on YouTube anymore.
An unfinished song that
Shot down. So what is the, I mean, and having like such like a long history, like what is the writing process or how do you guys put it together?
We pretty much, you know, we'll have the initial idea either come from, you know, Zach or myself, and we'll bring that in. And then it's not really a loose button song until the rest of the members put their little mark on it. You know, it's not a loose button song until Manny comes up with a beautiful bass line or Swagman with a beat that keeps it going. So that's pretty much how the songwriting works. And then we build these pieces on top of each other. And, you know, they go through many different versions until it's the perfect one.
But yeah, it usually starts with kind of either, I would say, like, a lot of riffs these days. Like,
yeah.
Riffs over even melodies. So we'll write, like, most of the music before we even throw a melody on top.
Mm-hmm.
Or vice versa. The melody and then everything else will grow from that.
Exactly. Exactly.
And you guys have a new song coming out this week, too, right?
Yeah, we have Crowded Room.
It's coming out on Yahoo Music, right?
Yahoo Music.
And what's the story behind that song?
That song is kind of, lyrically, it's about this daydream, in a sense, where, you know, you see a beautiful lady in the crowd, and you kind of just automatically have these visions of your future with her. And then but these futures do not come true. At the end of the day, she's just another girl with another guy.
Got it. Can we hear it?
We'd love to play it for you.
Thank you.
We'd love to.
Sunglasses that cover up her eyelids, and
Now I'm just dreaming, driving on the weekend. Wasted all my money on the weekend. Thoughts, conversation, could this make sense?
Nice. Very nice.
Thank you. Thank you.
So on top of that coming up, you guys have a EP coming out in the spring.
That's the plan.
how much of a plan is that?
We try to stick by, but yeah. You know, we're usually a few months off of what our actual target date is. But we're in the studio right now. We just built our own studio in Long Island City.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah. So we're in there working.
What went into that process?
We pretty much took a storage room. And,
like, is it in a storage building?
It's literally in a storage facility.
Is that fine? It sounds not fine.
It's technically legal.
Okay.
It's a space where a lot of bands are. They, like, understand.
It's actually a thing. A lot of bands do that.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's kind of one of the few places where you can be loud.
Exactly.
Right. And I guess, like, you can, it's just space.
Exactly.
And power. Right.
Exactly. So we went in there and, we're now in the process of making the aesthetics look nice, and
you got to dress up like a storage space.
Exactly. We just put Christmas lights all over the place.
Classic Christmas light. And what was the decision to build your own versus like going into working with the producer, going into another studio?
Well, and we're still in that process right now. But we thought it was smart for us to do the writing ourselves, really lock ourselves in a room, and the four of us hash it out.
Yeah.
And then bring in a fifth voice to then round it out a little bit more. And we're in the process now of talking to a bunch of different producers. We'll see. We know we've been talking to Rick Rubin and
is it one room, or were you able to subdivide the space?
No, it's one room.
Oh, interesting.
It's really more of a rehearsal / writing space than a recording space.
Okay, yeah. So you're not gonna record the record in there, or
probably not.
Think so.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. I mean, it's amazing like just how you can get so much further along these days. Do any of you have like production background or like the tech?
Actually, Manny is the one that mixes all of our music.
Thus far, yeah.
So all the recordings we've had, it's been Manny.
Do you mix with an iron ear, or are you open to suggestions?
I'm definitely open to suggestions. I think currently one of our issues is when you totally self-produce something and you have unlimited power and unlimited time to edit it and work on it, sometimes that's like too much power.
Yeah.
And you can get sort of caught in a loop of, well, let's go back and make it better. Let's go back and make it better. This is our art. It must be as art and good as possible.
Sometimes that constraint of, like, we only have a week to make this record, or, like, we have no money or things like that. Like, at some point, it's never going to be 100%.
You capture a time.
Yeah,
and that's exactly something that we haven't been doing.
And that's something we're looking to do with this new EP. We want to most likely have someone that isn't me produce it and do it in a much more, like, focused short period of time, and have it not be something that we can spend months and months going back to and then be like, actually, like, I really hate the bridge, let's just throw it out and write a new bridge. And which is something that we've done before.
Maybe you guys can buy like a giant like stop clock, or just like a countdown clock, and install it in the space and be like, we have to just
stick actually to this. A genius idea.
Genius.
Yeah,
do you want to be our producer?
Because I'll just throw out the ideas in there. But it is interesting to think about creative projects where, like, at some point it's like this long tail of like never, like, oh, I guess I could play, like, you know, a quarter note instead of a full note, and maybe just like, can we just open this back up or everything. And sometimes it's just good to have someone be like, you're done.
Yeah. And I think also just as a band, we've evolved a little bit. Our first EP 2 years ago, I think we were trying to be like really kind of artsy fartsy with the whole thing.
I mean, Wesleyan.
And right now, even songwriting wise as a band, we feel like we're trying to be a little bit more like raw, live indie rock fun, where it almost, like, you know, you don't need the record to have, like, you know, beautiful string arrangements or anything like that. It should just be like energetic and fun. And if you listen back and you're like, oh, that guitar's a little too loud, it's like, who cares, it's fine, it's not a big deal,
it's rock and roll, baby, you know.
Well, I want to make sure. Oh, were you going to say something?
I was going to say that rock and roll is actually our favorite sport.
Yes, thank you for bringing that up.
And I needed to get that in because it's so true.
It's your favorite sport?
It's our favorite sport,
We play it really hard, and we've gotten good at it.
We do drills.
Yeah, we do rock and roll drills.
What are your rock and roll drills?
Pretty much play to a click at rehearsal. But we're getting good at it.
It's amazing. Well, I want to make sure we have time to get in one more song. Where can people find the first EP shows, get all the information?
Definitely like us on Facebook. Search the band Loose Buttons.
SoundCloud.
SoundCloud, definitely. And if you pretty much go to those two areas, you will have all the information that you need.
Awesome. Well, I want to thank Peter for joining us. Please write in LA suggestions to win 2 free tickets to the sold-out festival. Shout out to my family. Shout out to my girlfriend. Why not?
That's what it's all about.
Happy 2016, guys.
You too.
It's going to be a good year.
Happy New Year.
What are you going to take us out with?
An oldie but a goodie. Two Wolves.
This one's still being played.
This one's still being played.
Yeah, okay. Very much. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you so much.
Gonna spend some time, a little bit of money, capture the ride. You'll hold the lens and let's pretend when he's never coming. I'm in some dream, living in your company. I'm in some dream, living in your company. Then you go. Spend a lot of money. Spend the night back at your room, wine and a spoon and a little honey. I'm in some dream, living in your company.
on some dream, living in your company. Him for yeah, loving you go. Two wolves that are haunting for loving you go. Two wolves that are haunting for loving we go.
Snacky Tunes is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.